10 out of 15 recommendations from the Military Compensation and Retirement Modernization Commission earn White House support, and the House includes some of those recommendations in its version of the 2016 National Defense Authorization Act. But one-third of the Defense Department's budget goes to military compensation, and some experts in the defense community say comp reform needs to be bigger than even the Comp Commission proposed. Major General Arnold Pinaro, U.S. Marine Corps retired, is chief executive officer of the Pinaro Group, and he says the recommendations are not bold enough. General, thanks for coming on the program. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Which of the recommendations that the group made did you like, sir? Thanks for joining me today.
Well, thank you. Always great to be on with you. And first of all, the commission really did a very solid job. They spent over 2 years. They were very thoughtful, very objective, and they put forward a number of key provisions that I'm enthusiastic about. One is the putting in a new system for the 85% of the military that never gets a nickel in retirement because they don't stay to 20. They had some very innovative proposals in terms of streamlining some of our retail sales, like combining the military exchanges and the military grocery system and reducing the taxpayer subsidy there. So they did a very, very good job. But the problem is it's a long-term, fully burdened and life cycle cost of what we've come to know as the volunteer force, where you now have over 2.4 million retirees, 1.1 million serving on active duty, and we're paying people for 60 years to serve for 20 years. So the commission really didn't address any of the long-term systemic problems that we have with the all-volunteer force.
One of the big conversations that's going on in public sector employee groups all over the country at all levels is that very issue that you just put your finger on, General, and that's in some cases there are more employees being paid to not work than there are being paid to work because of the way that the pension systems are structured. Is there a way politically, though, to get around that? It strikes me that one of the things, and of course none of them would ever say it, and I don't blame them, but it strikes me that maybe one of the things that the commission was getting at was trying to propose things that actually had a chance politically to become possible, not law necessarily, not always required, but at least possible, were things that were possible to happen.
Oh, I think they did that. I think first of all, to have 10 of the 15 supported by the Pentagon is a pretty remarkable achievement.
Mm-hmm.
The Pentagon, typically, when outside groups come in, they typically don't like any of it. So that's a pretty big feather in the commission's cap to start with. Both the House and the Senate are putting in the new 401k type provision, you know, for the vast majority of the service personnel that don't make it to 20 years, and a number of the other provisions. So I think you're correct. They did that, but I mean, what's happened in the public sector is the workforce, both active duty military, defense civilians, and even some defense contractors, have priced themselves out of business because the overhead costs. What people don't look at is they only want to look at the paycheck. But if you don't look at anything beyond the paycheck, if you don't look at your cost of health care, if you don't look at the cost of your facilities, you don't look at the cost of what it takes to own and operate the base, or the cost of training, the cost of your procurement, the cost of your research and development, the cost of your pensions, particularly when the incentive for the military, active military, is to retire if you're enlisted at age 43 and if you're an officer at age 45 and you live to age 85, and you have free health care and you have a fairly generous government pension, you've got to look at all those costs. And if you don't look at all those costs, then you're kidding yourself about whether your program is sustainable over the long term. So that's what's happened in the public sector.
And you're spot on, and that strikes me that that's as much a political problem as it is a compensation problem, because every time anybody brings up the idea of increasing TRICARE premiums, it can never get through Congress.
You're correct. I mean, in the political establishment, and being candid, this is not just in Washington. This is at the state, the local, and the federal level. There are no profiles encouraged when it comes to cutting people's benefits. And so what you end up is, over time, and this has particularly happened in the Department of Defense, they've added benefit after benefit after benefit. Nobody ever sat down and looked at what's the long-term cost of this. And this is why, of course, the military retirement system right now has a $1 trillion liability for future payments that's in nobody's budget, which is the whole total amount of money the sequester was supposed to save. And, of course, the sequester has done absolutely nothing to deal with the real drivers of our federal debt, which are health care and some of the other major entitlement programs. But you're correct. There are no profiles in courage when it comes to wanting to reform or cut benefits.
You talked about this issue recently at an event the Center for American Progress hosted. You were on a panel with two other terrific friends of this program, Phil Carter from CNAS and Larry Korb from CAP. You said something there, General, that caught my eye. You said, in the field, they're magnificent warriors, and in the Pentagon, they're magnificent bureaucrats. They'll study something for 20 years before they ever even want to make the smallest change. That doesn't give me a lot of hope that some of these changes, even if they're finally approved, will be implemented to the fullest effectiveness as proposed by the commission.
I mean, let me give you two really good examples of that. When Bob Gates was Secretary of Defense, and people would argue he was one of the most powerful, persuasive, dynamic Secretary of Defense, I called him a bureaucracy buster. In July 2010, he said, I'm going to cut the size of the Office of Secretary of Defense. When he left 2 years later, it was larger than it was when he made that announcement. In the commission's report, they recommended that we reduce the number of duty statuses for Guard and Reserve personnel. They're now 32, and they said, let's reduce it and streamline it to 6. When I chaired the Guard and Reserve Commission in 2005 to 2008, we made the same recommendation, and the Secretary of Defense and the entire department said they were totally in favor of it and they were going to do it. Now, this is 2008. The 11th Quadrennial Review of Military Compensation made the same recommendation, and the department said, we're totally in favor of this. We're going to do this. The commission's made the same recommendation that the Secretary of Defense agreed to in 2008, and the department's answer now is, oh, we need to study it more. So something they violently agreed with in 2008, they still haven't done.
How do we close that black hole so stuff doesn't keep getting sucked into it, General?
What you have to do is you have to get strong civilian and military leaders, and they need to be in their positions longer than 18 months. I mean, even in a for-profit corporation with CEOs, if the people turn over every 12 months or 18 months, I mean, it takes, in any kind of organization, changing the culture is the most difficult thing that you have. In the Pentagon, a lot of what has to change is the cultural change, and you have to be there long enough to basically make sure that the bureaucracy doesn't take a deep breath and think they can wait you out, because they've seen that that's been successful in the past.
That continues to be an issue not just at the Defense Department. That's all across the federal government, General.
That's correct.
The getting around that, the cultural issue, every time you and I have these conversations, we seem to come back to some kind of cultural issue inside the Defense Department that is a tougher nut to crack than the actual problem that we have at hand.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing, and the reason I make a strong distinction between in the field and in the rear with the gear is because, I mean, you go out in the field, and even around the United States, I'm not just talking about in wartime, you get outside of the Washington environment, and our Department of Defense, whether it's active duty military, Guard and Reserve, defense civilians, defense contractors, you know, they're shooting in the bullseye every day. But you get back into the bureaucracy in the Pentagon, and, I mean, they must measure success by, you know, I said facetiously one time, the ice age moves faster than the decision process in the Pentagon. And it's true. I mean, they just gum things to death. I mean, they'll get 75 people in a room and say, let's set up a study committee, and 10 years later, they're still looking at it.
It makes it even more striking that they have moved as quickly on at least 10 of these 15 as they have.
No, and that's a tribute to Ash Carter. I mean, Ash Carter is another just human dynamo that they have over there. And so, you know, you've got people at the top. Brad Carson, the new Undersecretary for Personnel and Readiness, he's putting forward some really bold and innovative personnel issues that, frankly, we haven't seen in the department in two decades. So you've, and Frank Kendall is a very hard charger. So you've got, but the problem is, as I say, you know, you've got these nuclear-powered leaders at the top, and you've got a big propeller, but you don't have the reduction gear. You have to get that nuclear energy and put it in a reduction gear so it drives the propeller.
General, it's always great to talk to you.
Yep.
Thank you for being on.
Anytime.